Hello and welcome back to the Slightly Fox podcast from Hoxton Square in East London. For those of you who don't yet know the Slightly Fox Quarterly, it's a literary magazine for non-conformists, people who like to read well beyond the bestseller lists. So every month we discuss lesser known and out of print books and the art of publishing. We also follow the goings on at this little magazine so that you can see how the production process works and get to know everybody. We're joined by expert bookish guests, and for each podcast we also choose a reading from the Slightly Foxed archive, which is full of treasures. There are three foxes around the table, including the two founders, Hazel Wood.
Hello.
And Gail Perkis.
Hello.
My name is Philippa Lamb. And also with us, Slightly Foxed web and social media queen, Jenny Harrison-Bunning.
Hello. It's very nice to be back here again.
Last month, I don't know if you'll have heard it, but last month we had a fascinating discussion about the art of editing from both the novelist's and the publisher's point of view. And today, we're going to look at illustration. So we record this podcast at the kitchen table, so please do forgive the inevitable noises off from phones and builders. Still, I'm afraid we have builders. And the dogs. We have all three with us this month, which may be a high-risk strategy. Jenny's talk is always very good and very quiet, but Gail, I have to say yours less so.
I'm afraid that Chudley is extremely badly behaved and always barks at anybody who comes through the door. And Stanley and Tarka like to play, and that's not always a very quiet business either.
And they're going to be collected for a walk shortly, aren't they?
I'm afraid my dear husband is going to take my two away.
This may be a noisy interlude at that point. I do think it's very nice having the dogs in the office, though. It must change the atmosphere.
It does. We don't often have dramas in the office, but occasionally you get somebody on the phone who really is just vile. And once or twice people have been reduced to tears, and it's very nice to have a dog too. And those moments when technology lets you down and when you just need to de-stress.
Because you are well ahead of the game here. I mean, Google and the rest, you can take your dogs in, but you've been doing this for years.
Yes, I mean, I suppose because it is a home as well as an office, so the dogs were here first.
So, Hazel, there's an issue coming out soon.
Yes, that's our spring issue, and it's at the printers at the moment. And it will be available on the 1st of March. It is very hard always to choose a favourite piece out of an issue, but I think my favourite this time was an extraordinary piece by Adam Sisman about a book called The Last Days of Hitler by Hugh Trevor Roper. At the end of the war, nobody really knew what had actually happened to Hitler. In order to quell the rumours, the historian Hugh Trevor Roper was detailed to actually find out what had happened to him. And it is a kind of detective story. He went to Germany, talked to many, many people, old Nazis and so on, and actually revealed the last days of Hitler, which were bizarre to a degree. Really strange things were going on.
In case you're wondering, that is the dogs being taken out for their afternoon walk.
And he did establish that Hitler finally had died. Apparently the Russians had left many, many papers there for him to read, and he interviewed a Nazi colonel who told him about what went on in the bunker. And apparently Goering was dressing up in white silk with antlers.
That's an extraordinary picture.
The strangest pigeon. Things were going on, and Hitler was literally chewing the carpet.
They were as mad as a bunch of frogs.
Yes,
they?
I mean, it was totally bizarre.
We had real problems illustrating this piece as well, for obvious reasons. I certainly didn't want a picture of Hitler. But we came across a wood engraving by somebody called Hilary Painter, and it's of the Jewish Memorial Garden in Berlin. The stone columns that are outside, all tilted at an angle, with olive trees growing out of the top of them. And I just thought it was a very nice counterpoint to the subject.
Absolutely. Jenny, what have you got?
Well, we've had news of the shortlist for our 2018 First Best Biography Prize, which we sponsor. And the prize is going to be awarded in a few weeks' time. And this year we're having a drinks reception at Mags Brothers, which is a very ancient sort of rare book and manuscript dealer. And it's a great shortlist, some really well-known books on there and some rarer ones too. There's Bart Van Es's The Cutout Girl, and then there's a really fascinating one by Fiona Sampson, In Search of Mary Shelley, 200 years after Frankenstein was written. So I'm looking forward to reading that one myself. And then there's Tara Westover's Educated, which was a smash hit last year, her memoir of escaping from a Mormon fundamentalist childhood. Through reading and how that helped change her life. And I think it was named as one of Barack Obama's top reads of last year. So little old Slightly Fox, it's on the pulse.
That's great. So as I said, we're exploring illustration. She wouldn't say so herself, but Gail is something of an expert in this area, and she commissions original work for the Quarterly and for many of the books that Slightly Fox publishes as well. We'll be joined by a very fine illustrator, David Eccles. Our extract from the Slightly Foxed archive this time is a piece about the work of another internationally renowned illustrator, the cartoonist, graphic artist and author Posy Simmons. If you have the December issue of the Quarterly, that's the 60th anniversary issue, you'll already know that it features her cartoons of everyone in the team here, including all the dogs. We will wrap up with some lesser-known book recommendations from everybody at the table. Illustration. It's a subject that's very dear, isn't it, to Slightly Foxed Hearts?
Yes, it is. I think when we started, we had a very clear picture in our mind of a certain type of illustration. And Hazel and I are both devotees of wood engravings and think that they are underrated. And we've tried to have a variety of illustration in each issue. Some are original illustrations taken from the books that we're discussing. Others we commission. But we've reissued quite a lot of memoirs which were illustrated by their authors. So Richard Kennedy's Boy at the Hogarth Press, Gwen Raverat's wonderful wood engravings in her memoir Period Piece.
Yes, and of course most recently Ernest Shepherd.
Yes.
Drawn from life and drawn from memory.
Ernest Shepherd was the man who illustrated Winnie the Pooh and Wind in the Willows. And then the other aspect of illustration, of course, is the covers, which we do on the whole commission from scratch.
Let me bring in our guest now, illustrator David Eccles. Thanks so
Hello.
Much for joining us.
Hello.
You're very well known for your work illustrating and designing for the Folio Society and their absolutely irresistible books. And the one I always think of you for is Now We Are 60.
That's really where I started, I think.
The pastiche on Now We Are 60.
The pastiche on Shepherd's wonderful drawings. We live in an age which is sort of digital, but the covers of books and the folio ones, people recognise them because they are pretty lavish.
Yes.
Quite often. To do that, you have to really go back to Gutenberg. The process of putting gold onto cloth on the boards of a hardbound book, it's to do with pressure and old-fashioned things like printing presses. So it's quite difficult because unless you have a lot of experience of how these things behave, you have really no idea.
So it really needs to inform the illustration you're producing?
Yes, I mean on a very, very basic level, because it's an old-fashioned letterpress type relief printing process where you transfer an image by pressure onto a rather recalcitrant material, you have to be fairly simple. Thin lines are always going to become thick, and very, very thick solids are always going to fill in.
Just before doing this recording, David and I were talking about he's designing images to go on the front of a series that we're going to be reissuing in September, Rosemary Sutcliffe's Roman Britain books. And David has come up with a motif for each of the first four titles in the series, combining a metallic foil and a second colour to create an image that's in period and in keeping, but also that links the four books together. I hope we're going to be using bronze ink and silver ink as well as gold.
It sounds very exciting. Mm. A lovely project. Mm.
For me, I think one of the basic underlying principles about choosing what to illustrate is a fairly important fundamental thing too. If the text paints a very vivid picture, that's probably not the thing you want to illustrate. After all, that would be a kind of tautology to do the same thing twice. On the other hand, an illustration can sometimes provide a kind of sideways look that the text has maybe not delivered inherently. An illustration can point you to something that's buried in the text, and it's always nice to try and do something that isn't quite the most obvious image that comes to mind.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that before. How, in terms of the commissioning process, if you're working with a publisher, do they say, we want five illustrations of this, or do you read it and talk up through what you think would work well? How does it work?
All sorts of different ways. Some commissioners can be very, very specific about what they want, even down to the size and the space that has to be filled. Other commissioners and, of course, Slightly Foxed fall into this category of very open about allowing you as the illustrator to come up with your own ideas. I tend to not know what I've got in my own head until I've drawn it. By drawing something, you solidify your own ideas. It's sometimes the equivalent of talking about something. You don't actually know beforehand what your opinions are, but by talking about them, you hear yourself uttering them. And it's a similar thing with drawing. So I tend to sketch very roughly anything that comes into my head, present what I think might be appropriate out of those ideas, trying to keep them as fluid as possible.
Can I butt in and give a wonderful example of the way David works? We, some time ago, had an article by Christopher Robbins on Finnegan's Wake. Christopher Robbins had never really seen the point of Finnegan's Wake until he went to Dublin and spent an evening in a pub where there was the classic pub ball talking, and it was an Irish stream of consciousness. It was a lovely article, and in the end, of course, Christopher Robbins, you know, says, "Ah, now I understand the point of Finnegan's Wake." And I gave this piece to David to illustrate, and the obvious thing to have done would have been to have had a man standing at the bar holding forth, but David didn't do that. He did an old-fashioned gramophone horn out of which pour this stream of words, all from Finnegan's Wake, and it is the most glorious image. Absolutely captured the spirit of the article and the intent of the author.
Thank you. And of course, Finnegan's Wake is, I would have said, almost impossible to illustrate. I mean, it's almost impossible to read, isn't it? And that sums it up, yeah.
I think of humour as being terribly tied up in my mind with your illustrations. And I'm always fascinated by how you can kind of extract humour, finding the joke,
yes,
but visually.
I usually tell people that if there's something humorous, I've stolen it, on the principle that plagiarism is this kind of flattery.
Yes.
I think if I have any skill, it is to do with pastiche. I think you can't pastiche somebody else unless you have some feeling for them. It doesn't have to be adoration, but you have to be somewhere on the same wavelength.
I always think pastiche is a slightly derogatory word, isn't it? And really, what you certainly have is a very highly developed sense of period.
I think that's what you meant.
So you have a sort of an artistic library.
It doesn't have to fool people to think that it was done by a 19th century illustrator. Some quality of line or composition, I think, will help that. I have had to do things in the style of other artists as commissioned, and certainly Shepherd was mentioned earlier, and we had this extraordinary business at Murray's with the A.A. Milne.
It was a pastiche.
Now We Are 60.
Yes. Now We Are 60. Yes. It was a pastiche of Now We Are 6, and David did illustrations for it.
And to the extent that when it was at the printers, the first one was at the printers, I got a call at the weekend from the publishers, and they said, panic, are the drawings you have done entirely your own work and nobody else's? Because there was a possibility of a copyright issue. And I said, well, of course not. No, these are meant to look like Shepherd.
Yes.
You know, this is the whole point. They're imitations. So, in fact, we had to change one drawing. I had to write a very grovelling piece to go at the front because there could have been an issue with the estate.
Yes. We had something rather similar happen with one of our covers, which was done by a man called James Nunn. I love Eric Revilius, and I asked James to do a pastiche of Eric Revilius's railway carriage, watercolour. In the background on the hill in the original, there's I think it's a white horse, and James changed that to a white fox in chalk. And
that's
on
the
carriage door, he put the number 17, which was the number of the issue. Anyhow, this cover came out, and it was marked as with apologies to Eric Revilius.
Yeah.
And I had a phone call from a publisher who will remain nameless, who's absolutely furious. How on earth did you manage to get permission to reproduce an Eric Revilius on your cover? I've been trying for years, and I've never managed it. Well, I had to say to her, actually, It isn't.
Interesting. We're talking of cover design. Let's hear from one of the other artists that Slightly Fox has worked with, and that's Angie Lewin. She's a printmaker and artist and a sometime illustrator, and of course she's very well known for her seed head designs on greeting cards and furnishing fabrics. I asked her about a cover that she did for Slightly Foxed.
I chose to do a garden with sort of an urban fox in, and actually it was a great opportunity to use sort of autumnal colours, those sort of russet colours of the fox, and my sort of signature seed heads and botanical subject matter, and yet bringing some wildlife into it too, which is a slight challenge for me actually. But yeah, it just evolves. It's a nice collaboration that I enjoy really, and it seems quite a fluid thing for me. And covers now are so, you know, you want people to pick up an actual book, and so to see a beautifully crafted cover. I mean, Captain Corelli's Mandolin had an amazing cover by Jeff Fisher. You know, you would just see it and think, that book looks amazing. I think seeing the covers, it's not a sort of shallow way to choose a book. You're attracted to a skillful pairing of illustrator, art director, author, and when it works, it's incredibly memorable, I think.
Gail, you mentioned earlier you started to talk about commissioning covers. What's in your mind when you commission a cover for a new issue?
One is that I like the artist's work, and I'm afraid I'm very subjective about this and slightly dictatorial as well, in the sense that if anybody else in the office expresses a contrary opinion, I bristle slightly.
Is that right, Jenny? Is that your experience?
Bit of a
yes.
Yes.
So but what informs the choice?
Our covers are halfway between fine art and illustration. I like to vary the medium. And when I brief the artist, the only criteria really are the size, which season it is, and there has to be a fox or an allusion to a fox in it somewhere.
In fact, David's cover was fantastic.
David
his
did
fox.
That was the cleverest cover.
Yes,
yes.
He did an awesome cover.
Oh, yes.
It's a rather higgledy-piggledy farmhouse, and it's lit up inside. Then there's a night sky, and David invented a constellation of stars called Vulpus Major.
Of course, the great fox.
We had subscribers ringing up saying, "Where's the fox?" I said, "Look
outraged
in the sky."
Yes, so we do get letters if we don't put a fox in. And sometimes if we've had a cover without a fox, we've had to commission a special little fox to go at the top of the cover so that there is a fox there somewhere.
You see, Gail, you may think you're in charge, but actually your readers are in charge. Yeah. Jenny, I mean, from your point of view, all this wonderful visual imagery, it must be great.
It's fantastic, yeah. I mean, if we take the originals and make them digital, we can then share them on the website. I'll use them, especially on Instagram, which is incredibly visual. Mm. The trouble is David never really lets us credit him for anything. So he's, you know, I'm probably not allowed to say this, but we've got his work in all sorts of issues of the magazine under various pseudonyms.
Nom de plume,
yeah.
I suppose.
Which
yes,
we're not going to reveal, are we?
I don't think we will.
No.
I'm guessing we've whetted people's appetites for this. So if they go on the website, mm-hmm. presumably they can see quite a lot of the work we've described. Foxquarterly.com?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And obviously, if you'd actually like to see the quarterly in itself, you can get it in bookshops, can't you? You don't have to subscribe.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I spotted the fox out in the wild up in Waterstones, Islington.
It's hardly the wild. This is North London for people.
I know, but that's in, you know, sort of out in the real world. You can. You can pick up single copies in all sorts of bookshops, and there's an area on the website which lists all of our stockists.
I'd be interested to know, just run around the table, favourite illustrations do you have? A particular one?
As a child, I can remember being tremendously impressed by Mervyn Peake's illustrations for Treasure Island. And there's, I think, an illustration of his of Blind Pugh tapping his stick on the road, which is absolutely terrifying.
In fact, his illustrations for his own, for the Gormenghast trilogy, what was the chef called?
Swelter.
Swelter, with his enormous meat cleaver. And then the twins, who are very peculiar people indeed, and Steerpike, who looks scheming and
skeletal.
You know that this is not going to turn out well. I mean, they were quite remarkable, weren't they?
Yes.
I think sort of recently, I've fallen in love again with E.H. Shepherd because of these two little autobiographies. They are just so charming and funny as well. And Su Ji, who wrote about them, pointed out that the captions actually are also part of it. They're just little extracts, you know, left out in the cold or being sick.
Very teasers.
Little teasers. Lovely. I've loved those books.
We will have book recommendations a bit later on, but let's move on to this month's reading from the Slightly Foxed Archive. And this time, we're very fortunate to have the actress Petra Markham reading an extract for us. It's from a piece all about another writer-illustrator. Hazel, you wrote this piece, so why don't you introduce it for us?
Well, during the 1970s, I suppose all Guardian readers eagerly waited every week Posy Simmons's cartoon about a family called the Webbers. It was about them and their circle of friends and their very, very difficult children. We love Posy. She's done a great many things for Slightly Foxed.
It was towards the end of the 1970s that I first met the Webbers. George, senior lecturer in liberal studies at the local polytechnic, bespectacled, moustached, and normally clad in a hairy pullover. His wife, Wendy, mother of six, ex-nurse turned children's author, dressed, as many of us were in those days, in ethnic beads and slightly tired-looking Laura Ashley, and the Webber children. Oh, and I mustn't forget Pussy, the Webber's podgy and suspicious cat. We tended to see them once a week, often in the Webber's homely, but by now somewhat shabby, stripped pine kitchen, over a glass of George's homemade plonk and one of Wendy's Elizabeth David cassolets. I really got to know them quite well. I liked and identified with Wendy. Harassed, conscientious, a bit sharp, and weighed down by a terrible sense of guilt and social obligation. I understood her aggravations and her angsts. An outbreak of nits at school. Unreasonable demands from the twins' form teacher for instant Robin costumes for the Christmas play. I shared Wendy's disapproval of the way her daughter Belinda allowed her stubbly boyfriend Jasper to treat her. After all, what had we women's libbers been fighting for? George was a dear too, though he did tend to go on rather in a liberal studies, postmodern kind of way. Like us, the Webbers couldn't afford what Wendy with a sniff called expensive foreign holidays, but sent postcards from Tresoddit, the little place they always went to in Cornwall. Altogether, I felt we shared the same world, albeit a virtual world, created by Posy Simmons in her weekly cartoon strip in The Guardian. How sharply, yet affectionately, it captured the aspirations, snobberies and hypocrisies of us woolly urban liberals, and how we all loved it. Somehow it validated us, helped us lighten up and laugh at ourselves. Of course, we weren't quite like these people, we told one another, but we certainly knew people like them. In 1999, she came up with something even more ambitious, a graphic novel, Gemma Bovary, which ran for 100 episodes in The Guardian and finally appeared between hardcovers. Gemma is Flaubert's heroine, brought up to date. The bored, pretty second wife of ineffectual Charlie Bovary, who flees horrid Hackney for the idyll of expatriate life in Normandy. Predictably, the idyll wears thin, and the book charts Gemma's ruin via her diary and through the eyes of Gemma's neighbour, the intellectual baker Raymond Joubert. It gives Posy the chance to have great fun with the English dream of rural life in France. After Gemma came Literary Life, another collection of Posy's weekly cartoons. For anyone who has ever lingered in bookshops, attended a book launch or a literary festival, it is essential reading. Posy's dialogue is as good as her draftsmanship, and she has a talent for names which is as good as that of Evelyn Waugh or Anthony Pohl. What enchants and convinces in all her work is the brilliantly observed detail. If Posy draws a French coffee pot, it is a completely authentic French coffee pot. The appearance of her characters, toddlers, sulky teenagers, pushy mothers, angst-ridden authors, pretentious publishing types, is always spot on. This kind of texture, she says, is the equivalent of verbal description in a novel. I heard Posy speak at St. Martin's School of Art, where she was once a student. In person, she's slight and modest in manner, with only the merest hint of the sharp irony she brings to her drawing and writing. I sketch all the time, but not in front of people. That's too inhibiting. When I'm at home working on a character, I think to myself, I want this kind of nose and this kind of mouth, and I go to my sketchbook. I knew Gemma Bovary had to have big coal-fringed eyes, like Princess Diana, who was very much in the news at the time. Gemma had two lovers, so underwear was important, because they had to dress and undress a lot. As for Raymond Joubert, the baker and narrator, I saw him in a bar in Brittany. He was wearing those big shoes with gritty bottoms, and I thought, I know you. That's just how I feel when I encounter Posy's own creations. The proprietor of Tresoddit's health food shop, Kevin Penwallet, or the sullen novelist J.D. Crouch, author of Out of Flatley, or Sally Muspratt, George Webber's colleague at the Poly, or I could go on and on. It's impossible to convey the wit and charm of Poe's work in mere words. As the estate agents say, viewing is essential.
Very good piece, Andrew.
Petra Markham there, reading Hazel's article on the cartoons of Posy Simmons, the intellectual baker. Only Posy could have come up with that. I love that. Time is getting on. Tell me what you've all discovered lately. What have you been reading?
I've had a very unadventurous time, I'm afraid, recently, because I had flu. And very easy read. It's a book I go back to whenever I'm feeling particularly miserable, is Paul Gallico's Flowers for Mrs. Harris, which is a very sweet, kind, gentle book about a London char lady who conceives an ambition to buy a Christian Dior dress. It's about how she goes about fulfilling her dream, and it is enchanting.
When does that date from?
I think it's the early 60s. A lot of people would say that it is a rather false imagining of a sentimentalisation, but it is rather a special story, and he was a very, very good storyteller.
There's a piece about it, actually, isn't there, in an earlier issue? I think Maggie Ferguson did a lovely piece. Well, I've just finished reading a book that I discovered in Slightly Foxed, actually, in the autumn issue, The Tortoise and the Hare by Elizabeth Jenkins. It was reprinted by Virago, and I absolutely loved it. I just was completely gripped. It's this story of this sort of young, incredibly attractive woman and this middle-aged woman who is not sort of man-killer as such. Right. But she has an affair with this younger woman's husband.
Ah.
And it's all about how it sort of all comes out and there's lots of intrigue. And it was one of those books that I was really cross to finish. So I kept sort of flicking to see how many pages were left and then making myself put it down so that it would just last
a bit longer.
Another day.
David.
Well, I've just finished, which will sound incredibly pretentious, Compass. It's recently published, translated from the French by a chap called Mathias Hénard, and it's a sort of monologue. The frame of it is a man who can't get to sleep at night, so it's got this Proustian trail to it. But the gist of the book is the interaction of the East and the West throughout history. So it's got a lot about Middle East and exploration there, woven into a kind of slightly tantalizing but simple story. He has a girlfriend, but they never seem to be able to get together somehow, which keeps you wanting to know how it's going to finish. Slightly overwritten. It's got a huge amount of information in it that I didn't know.
It sounds like a challenging
read.
Yes,
it is a challenging read, I think. My wife said she wasn't going to touch it.
So, for people with time on their hands, I think, and a curious mind. Hazel.
Well, as we're talking about illustration today, I'd like to recommend the autobiography of the illustrator Kathleen Hale, who did the Orlando books.
The Marmalade Cat.
Orlando the Marmalade Cat. Like a lot of creative people, Kathleen Hale didn't do well at school. Her father died when she was three, and she was sort of farmed out to relatives and was then sent to Manchester High School for Girls, I think. And she was just hopeless at work. But fortunately, her head, a rather formidable head, appreciated her sort of artistic gifts and even gave her a sort of special presentation scroll when everyone else was getting their exam results. She was given a scroll with nothing on it, just so that she had something to hold.
That's very touching.
Actually persuaded her to go to Reading Art School. She then left home and went to London and lived the absolute sort of ultimate bohemian life. There were two groups, really. There was Jacob Epstein, who was rather sort of severe and intellectual, and the circle surrounding Augustus John. And for a lot of the time, she had been starving in a garret, although she was terribly tough. She says at one point, "It wasn't bad. I never went without food or drink for more than about 2 days."
Uh-huh.
But then she went to work for Augustus John and became his secretary. But anyway, after all this, during the First World War, I suppose, in London and after, she then was rather desperate, really, to settle down and have children. Naturally, she was always in very bad health, so she got a terrible throat infection, was taken into hospital, fell in love with her consultant. He was a charming, you know, very cultivated man, divorced, but he decided he was really too old for her, so he sort of persuaded, in a way, her to marry his son, who was the absolute antithesis of her. He was also a doctor. She was somewhat depressed on the first night that they spent together, that he spent the evening reading The New Statesman and then was rather surprised that she minded.
I can see her point.
But somehow they sort of got it together and they bought a house outside London. They created a beautiful garden, had two sons, and it was somehow one of those strange marriages that was of complete opposites. But it worked, and she was devastated when he died. But she went on painting to the very end, and, you know, she was an amazing draftswoman. She also had that sort of innocent eye, but very, very observant. So though she was no stylist, the book is just full of wonderful, fresh observation. Sorry, I've gone on about it rather. It's just such a lovely book.
But people will have to wait until our own edition comes out. Don't all go off and buy a tatty paperback.
Absolutely
wait
not.
For the Slightly Fox edition.
Thank you all very much. There's very, I think, diverse is probably the way to describe those suggestions. I should add at this point that you never need to worry about keeping notes of all the books or writers that we mentioned, because we do all that for you. Jenny, do you want to just tell people where they can find the show notes?
Yeah, so the show notes, we do them for every episode, and they're on the podcast section of the Slightly Foxed website, which you'll find at foxedquarterly.com/pod. And all of the details of the books that we've mentioned are there, and links to any articles that we've shared, and all sorts of other little bits and bobs.
And they are very detailed, those show notes. They're fantastic.
Well, that's about the end of our fourth episode then. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as we've enjoyed doing it. It's been tremendously good to have David Eccles. Thank you very much, David.
Sure.
So we'll say goodbye for now, and we'll be back on March the 15th with another episode.
And we'll be talking then about republishing books. How are out-of-print or long-lost books rediscovered and reprinted? We'll be joined by a great exponent of the art, Donna Coonan. She's editorial director of Virago Modern Classics, and that, of course, is the list which brought back into print many hundreds of the best women writers of the past. Join us then. In the meantime, thanks for listening and for venturing with us off the beaten track.